Tonight on The Download, Simeon and Whitney Young basketball coaches Rob Smith and Tyrone Slaughter. From the NRDC Midwest office, Henry Henderson. And live music in Studio 435 from Chicago's Hafringa. Now, here's your host, a man who was on a clear liquid diet to prep for tonight's show, Justin Kaufman.
Gotta be prepped. You know, chicken broth, a little Jell-O. Mix some of that powder in with the Gatorade, you're all set. It's time for showtime. How's everybody doing? It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Great to be back. Like I said, it's been about a week, man. We were on last Wednesday. And then Thanksgiving happened, Blackhawks hockey happened. We're back here on the air tonight. And we have a great show lined up for you. As we mentioned, the high school hardwood legends, coaches Rob Smith and Tyrone Slaughter. Rob Smith of Simeon, Tyrone Slaughter, Whitney Young join me to talk about the Chicago Elite Classic shootout at the UIC Pavilion Friday and Saturday. Bring together not just those schools and schools from Chicagoland area in the state, but teams from across the country. This is one of the big sort of deals for high school basketball around the United States, and it's right here in Chicago this weekend. So we'll talk with them about how they prepare their students, their student athletes, before, during, and after a life of basketball. That'll come up in the 9 o'clock hour. Coming up at the 8 o'clock hour at the big table, Henry Henderson's going to join us, the first ever Department of Environment Commissioner for the City of Chicago, brought in the mid '90s. Deal with the after effects of Operation Silver Shovel, which we remember was where they were dropping waste in different neighborhoods and paying off aldermen to do so. We brought him in, and you know, he's a perfect guy. He works for the NRDC now. We'll talk to him about climate change and what specifically does Chicago have to deal with. You see all the footage about what's happening other places, even in our country, in New York and Miami, on the West Coast with drought. But what about Chicago? What about the Chicago area? So we're going to talk about tonight at the big table as we figure out what the issues are before the big symposium as mayors from around the country are coming to Chicago next week for the big climate summit here in Chicago. Also, Bob Garfield's going to join us. He is the longtime co-host of the program On the Media, which airs in public radio across the country. What a day to have him on, huh? You know, our media voices from New York to Lake Wobegon are no longer with us after allegations of sexual harassment led to the firing of Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor. We'll talk with Bob Garfield about that story and also the story earlier that surfaced with the Washington Post about Project Veritas and creating fake news, trying to lure the Washington Post into fake stories to essentially get them on the hook to show their bias. Talk about how that's changing the way that media is being approached, not just by the people who make it, but do we have, as the media, should we be opening our doors and being more transparent about how the stories are being made? Is that what has to happen next? I mean, there are a lot of times people say, you don't want to see how the sausage is made. You're more interested in the final product. But because of all these things that are happening around the country and the onslaught that's coming from Washington, D.C. and in the White House about news and fake news, is it important for our media agencies to be as transparent as they possibly can? We'll have that conversation coming up in the 9 o'clock hour as well. And Half Gringa, the I love this, Rowdy Rural Rock. Chicago band will be in studio 4:35 tonight. We usually do it on Mondays, but we're doing it tonight on Wednesday nights. You get Half Gringa in studio. We're gonna turn this studio out. It's going to be great. It's all tonight. A big show. Coming up in the first hour here, we're going to talk about female investors investing in female startups, female-led startups. That's going to be our conversation with Diamond. The company is dedicated to funding female startups in Chicago. There's some stats that are just alarming about how much money is being provided for female-led startups in the tech industry and startups in general, business startups. But for every $100 that a man would get, women, I think it's like $3. So, I mean, it's crazy to think about how wide the gap is when it comes to angel investors. So we'll do the download in Chicago business tonight. We'll talk with Diamond about trying to correct that gap. That's coming up tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, Esmeralda Leon, production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. Where in the world is Matt Lauer? Well, it turns out he's locked in his office. The latest to be fired for sexual harassment. Variety put out a piece today detailing the accusations against the Today Show anchor, including details about his behavior covering the Olympics, and that he had a button under his desk to lock his office door. No word on whether or not Matt Lauer is getting paid the rest of his multi-million dollar contract. Lauer joins Charlie Rose, Kevin Spacey, Louis C.K., Al Franken, Bill O'Reilly, Harvey Weinstein, just to name a few. All powerful celebrity New Yorkers. Interesting coincidence. Just a coincidence, maybe. Quickly after the news this morning, President Trump tweeted about it, saying the executive should be fired at NBC for fake news. Kind of the last guy who should be weighing in on this story, right? Trump's like the guy who hangs around a crime scene asking the police what they know. Do you have any leads? Do you know who could have done this? I wasn't anywhere near this. For a dude that has a lot of dirt on him, you'd think he'd just retweet anti-Muslim extremist videos as a distraction. Wait a second. Yep, a reply all president has done it again, retweeting vile videos because, well, his water reclamation buddy showed it to him around Thanksgiving. I mean, we are his boss, right? Is there no HR department in the White House? Can we at least write him up for violating our country's social media policy? I mean, it's right there in the handbook. And while you're at it, those long ties, they break uniform code. That's another write-up. Also, clean up your workstation. Back to sexual harassment. Garrison Keillor was let go from his contracts at Minnesota Public Radio for an allegation against him. He did an interview with AP today saying that it was about how he touched a woman's bare back while consoling her. She recoiled from the unwanted touch and he apologized. And that's it so far. No word from NPR or the woman yet. Keillor also said that he's 75 and he doesn't want to argue about it in public. Instead, he'll do a really slow monologue accompanied by Lake Wobegon sound effects and a piped-in laugh track. Man, Charlie Rose and Garrison Keillor. I'll bet Oscar the Grouch right now, keeping a pretty low profile. Luis Gutierrez is not running for re-election in Congress. Speculation has run wild on why. Was it an allegation of improper conduct? Oh, God, no worse. The rumor is he wants to run for president. Oh, he won't rule anything out. Cook County Commissioner Chuy Garcia is the anointed one to replace him, but Chicago Alderman Proco Joe Moreno and Carlos Ramirez Rosa have shown interest in running in the March primary. Everybody wants to be a congressman, or nobody wants to be a congressman. I can't tell. Governor Rauner stepped in it today. During a radio interview, he called Comptroller Susana Mendoza a Madigan puppet. Clever, but sexist. Many are calling out the governor for not respecting Mendoza, an elected official, for having a mind of her own. Say what you will, but I'm not sure anyone ever called Judy Bart Topinka a George Ryan puppet. Right? I think people should call out Rauner for sexism instead. I say call him out for cliche and tired bits. The puppet stuff, it's the local version of hashtag sad, right? Puppet. American Airlines gave too many pilots vacation time for Christmas, and now there's a shortage, and the airline is scrambling to find replacements so they don't have to cancel flights. What's our emotion supposed to be here? Do we feel bad for American Airlines? Or angry? Or slightly miffed? And where's Trump? I'm telling you, the next politician that steps up and becomes our advocate against the airline industry, against their practices and their pricing, they're not just going to be president. They're going to be emperor. More people coming out of the woodwork to question the deal that has the state of Illinois put that is wooing the second Amazon headquarters. The Chicago Reader reported that part of the deal is that employees wouldn't have to pay state income taxes. Instead, the money collected would just go to Amazon. What? That's a thing? Can we hire other companies to come in and be our new government? I mean, I'd be okay with it if the state government was replaced by, I don't know, Chipotle. I mean, a little norovirus here and there, but that's no different than the heartburn we already get. And think of the perks. Free queso. I'm in. I vote Chipotle. In weather, what a beautiful day. Beautiful day for a ton of delays. Train delays, the worst. Union Station, kind of a mess. See if they get it together by tomorrow morning. In sports, the Bears play the 49ers on Sunday. The 49ers and Bears have done almost nothing to improve upon last year, where they both finished towards the bottom of the league. Last year, the Bears beat the Niners late in the season to give the 49ers a better draft pick. So how about we tank this one, huh? The only interesting storyline is that the 49ers will start newly acquired quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo. Garoppolo, local kid, played at Rolling Meadows, went to EIU. So that should at least guarantee some warm bodies at Soldier Field on Sunday. I mean, for the family, right? In other news, the Bears are bringing back linebacker Lamar Houston, who was waived by the Texans. Houston played here for a couple years. His biggest play? Blowing out his knee during a sack dance when we were getting routed by the Patriots. You remember that? Nobody remembers that. He gets mentioned all day. Well, Lamar Houston's back in a Bears uniform. We were getting beat by 40 points, getting annihilated during the Mark Trestman era. And he got a sack and he decided to jump up and do a dance and he fell to the ground with a torn ACL. Somehow, we just forget. Nikola Mirotic is back in practice with the Bulls. He's accepted Bobby Portis' apology for a preseason fight that broke bones in his face, but still the Bulls. They lost to the Phoenix Suns last night to fall to 3-16 on the season. 3-16 and at the bottom of the Eastern Conference. No, wait. Nope, this just in. Bottom of the entire NBA. That's right. The Bulls are the worst team in the entire NBA. I wouldn't worry about it. Season doesn't really start till Christmas. Get it corrected by then. Northwestern Wildcats basketball lost a heartbreaker last night at the buzzer to Georgia Tech. Not a great start for the Cats, who are now 4-3. The Illini had started the season 6-0, feasting on a bunch of liberal arts colleges. They got their first test of the season last night against Wake Forest, and they lost. They're now 6-1. In football, Northwestern moved up to 21 in the rankings. They're beating the Illini. The season's over, and we'll find out what bowl game they play in come Sunday. And finally tonight, a new DNA study says that the famed Yeti, the abominable snowman, the Yeti, it turns out it has the DNA of Asian bears, therefore making it a bear, not a monster snow beast. Is nothing sacred anymore, science? Next, you're going to tell me that the Loch Ness Monster is just an Asian carp. No! That's the carryout for November 29th, 2017. Hey, we're enjoying this nice weather, but nobody's ordering the chili. So how about chili shakes? Huh? I think we're onto something. All right, coming up, we'll talk about female investors investing in female-led startups. That's the download on Chicago Business. And then Henry Henderson's going to join us at 8 o'clock. Talk about what to expect from the Symposium on Climate Change coming up next week. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
It's business time.
Yes, it's time for the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our weekly segment where we talk with CEOs and entrepreneurs about their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, the business of investing, specifically in female-owned and operated startups. The firm Diamond is launching a new campaign to get women more involved in investing. A study from 2013 showed that women only represented 19% of all angel investors in the United States. Diamond is a financial firm that helps women with financial empowerment. Diamond CEO Carolyn Leonard was one of the first traders on the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, and she's translated her experience into Diamond and Diamond Angels, built with the goal to not only get more women involved in investing, but to invest in female-led startups. The goal is to raise close to $2 million. CEO Carolyn Leonard and Chief Strategy Officer Monica Black in studio tonight. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start. I want to start, Carolyn, with your story, because I think when we talk about the financial industry in Chicago, when we talk about CBOE and other places, There's a storied tradition, but some of the issues, especially when it comes to gender equality, they go way back. I mean, you faced those when you started in the business as a trader.
Right. I started in 1976, and at that time, there weren't female traders trading actively on the floor of the Chicago Board of Options Exchange. And when I decided that if men could make that kind of money trading, obviously there was opportunity down there. I didn't understand, however, that there were tremendous barriers just based on gender. And when I first started trading, some of the very largest brokers who handle public paper came up to me and they said, you know, sweetheart, it's wonderful that you came down here, but I've never traded with a woman. I'm not going to trade with you. And by saying that, it emboldened other men to say, oh, if you're not trading with her, none of us
was it to. Just was it just brutish, piggish behavior, or was there, what was their rationale? Were they just chauvinistic guys in 1976?
I think it was a lot more bias. And today we have unconscious bias. There it was very conscious. And they felt that if they could, they could get rid of me because, you know, access to earn a living meant access to a paper to trade. And so I had to figure my way around.
How did you do it? I mean, with being one of the only females on the floor, how did you get past the idea of these barriers, these walls?
Well, I decided that being a woman was a real problem. You ain't seen nothing yet, boys. And so I went into my closet. I was newly divorced. I had been married to a very successful man. I had an incredible wardrobe. And every morning I'd reach into my wardrobe, and it maybe looked like a very pretty feminine dress, but that was armor. And I went down on that floor in 4-inch stilettos and a very lovely suit of armor because we were at war. And what started to happen is people, because there weren't women, would say, oh, you got to see what she's wearing today. And so brokers that didn't know, because I was a woman, they shouldn't trade with me, would have paper. They'd come in the pit. They'd stand next to me because they wanted to see what I had on that day. And because they were standing next to me, they would talk to me. And because they talked to me, they traded with me. So I was able to overcome a lot of that guys not wanting to trade with me because I was a woman. And one of the funniest things is that other brokers that wouldn't trade with me would run after the broker that filled paper and had me on that ticket. And he would say, we don't trade with her. And of course, the ego of the other guy would be, well, nobody tells me who I don't trade
with. Right.
So for sure, they traded with
me. Well, Monica, listening to that story, you want to believe it's an isolated or it's a bygone era. Mm-hmm. You want to think about Carolyn's story that she's talking about and how she had mm-hmm. to persevere past barrier, mm-hmm. climb walls and actually knock walls down. Mm-hmm. But as we talk about the tech industry and startups and mm-hmm. everything in between right now, those issues of trying to narrow the gender gap, they're still there. And it's surprising with some of the stats that I was even looking at today. It seems to be festering.
It is festering. And I think as we've gotten into this and spoken with a lot of female entrepreneurs out there to hear the stories that, you know, listen, we thought that maybe it had gotten a little bit better, but really the stories were just quiet and there wasn't enough safe space for people to talk about it. And so a lot of the barriers that female founders, small business owners are experiencing, they're not being understood by the male investors. And the male investor doesn't see the solution to the problem that she's solving as a one that's relevant or reasonable. And a lot of that is because he doesn't deal with those problems. And so we just have a lot of unconscious bias. We have a lot of conversations that we need to have where we need to bridge the gap so that men understand the problems that women face every day. Therefore, the solutions that she has are actually viable solutions. We've heard from founders that they struggle to help investors understand that there's even a market in a particular area. They're spending time just justifying the market when the market's already been proven and you could go up to 5 potential female investors and they'd go, oh, absolutely,
it
I understand.
Very similar to what you were just talking about with paper and everything, that there seems to be some people that are just automatically behind the times or naysayers.
Right. And one of the things when it comes to investing is that people tend to invest in people that look like them. So for women to as founders or entrepreneurs, for them to have access to equity, we have to build up more women investors in that space.
You know, there's so many stats that I came across, and I mentioned one at the top of the show, the idea that for every $100 that is invested into male led startups, $3 of that same money is in female led startups. Is that because there's not enough female investors in the pool that guys are comfortable in investing in their gender, like you just mentioned, the idea that how they look like, or is there something else at play?
Well, a large part of it is that women do solve problems. They don't create an app that's really going to be the best dating app you've ever seen. They're looking to solve a real-life situation problem. And people do invest in people who look like themselves. The other thing is that if you're a minority, if you're African-American, if you're Hispanic, Latino, a male can get $1.3 million from a venture capital firm, and an African-American woman can get $36,000. So that statistics are even more glaring and difficult with the more factors of diversity you have.
And the other thing, and we mentioned this a little bit in, right before we came on air, but this idea that there's also the bias of an industry, of money managers and others who may want to dissuade women from becoming investors because, as they say, it's too risky, or they find a way to maybe talk women out of riskier ventures instead of saying, go for it with guys.
Well, this is one of the things we found in Diamond when we began 5 years ago and really started focusing on challenges that women were facing in the relationship with money. And regardless of net worth, one thing that stood out to us is that women are often seen just in the financial industry as not being competent. And, oh, sweetie, we'll take care of your money for you. And so because of that, the sort of overall judgment about risk in women is, oh, women aren't as risky as men. And we really have pivoted the game on that because we think women take risks all the time. We are willing to invest in each other and support each other in amazing ways. And if you look at that and the fact that we really want to invest our values, then angel investing becomes a natural opportunity and fit. So I think if you look at things and not the sort of traditional patriarchal model of finance, and you look at how women work in the relationship with money and how they want to leverage their money to help what we call at Diamond their care network, the people that they feel emotionally and financially responsible for, but also to invest in those values, this is a natural bridge for her. And as Carolyn mentioned earlier, there's less risk when you actually invest in female founders because she's had to bootstrap so much longer that by the time she's actually seeking money, she's already got product out there.
Right. That's Chief Strategy Officer Monika Black and CEO Carolyn Leonard, both of Diamond. We're talking about their goal of trying to raise just about $2 million coming up here to help with female-led startups here in the area, but also elsewhere. Let's do this. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll continue the conversation with Diamond in studio in the Downloader Chicago Business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's a Download on Chicago. Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank here on the Download 720 WGN. CEO Carolyn Leonard and Chief Strategy Officer Monika Black from Diamond in studio tonight, talking about the goal to not only get more women involved in investing, but to invest in female-led startups. The campaign, the 1920 Vote Your Money campaign, we'll get into that in just a second. I found it interesting a lot of what Diamond does, and you talk about financial empowerment.
Yeah.
And the root word there is power. And I think about the not only the abuses of power that you talked about being on the trading floor, the exchange floor, but also money managers and others and men saying, don't worry, sweetheart, I'll take care of your money. But there, it seems like power when it comes to the financial industry and finances, it's a hard nut to crack.
Absolutely. And there's a paternalistic attitude about it. In fact, if you look at the industry and you look at just vocabularies for products and stuff like that, it's mind-boggling. It's hard to wrap your brain around exactly what it is. They use acronyms. They have their own special language with everything. And these are all barriers to entry. And we know that women, unless they can check every box in terms of knowledge, will think, oh, I just don't know enough.
Right.
And so rather than being empowered, they feel, oh, I'm just not as literate as I should be.
People take advantage of that discomfort.
Absolutely. But when we look at the data, it's women know as much as men know. Men are just better at that act of confidence and making people think that they know a little bit more. And so if we can also understand that each woman has an emotional relationship with money, most women are making most of the financial decisions at home. Most women are making the healthcare decisions at home, where their children are going to go to school. If you factor up all these different components and you help women to see, actually, I've been managing our family's money for all these years without getting credit for it, then each woman really is her own CFO. And that's our model. That's what we want each woman to understand, that she is not only making those decisions for herself, but for her family, but for her community as well. And she deserves the right service model.
When we talk about the campaign, because I mentioned that the goal is really to raise close to $2 million. But it starts with the 1920 Vote Your Money campaign. Talk about this, why it's named the 1920 Vote Your Money campaign, but also the goal.
It's the 1920 campaign because that's when the 19th Amendment was ratified. That was not when everybody got the right to vote, but it was the beginning. And just like getting more women involved and running in managing their finances from a position of strength and power, it's a process to help women get there. And we want her to be in charge and understand that she has a lot of power in her purse. Women are on track to control $22 trillion of investable assets by 2020. We're not a niche market. We are powerful, and we just have to step up to the plate and understand that in our relationship with money, it, like any relationship, we're in the driver's seat instead of deferring to somebody that we view as having power like a financial advisor.
And so right now for the campaign, we're starting with our first 100 days. And so we're asking 100 women to contribute $1,000 in 100 days to kick off this campaign. We think it's really important where Chicago's got so many female founders, thriving female-led organizations, that this is our opportunity to say, hey, look, Chicago, we're seriously invested in this, and this is our greatest opportunity, and we are looking for a collective impact for women. After the 100-day campaign, we're going to have opportunities for all women in Chicago to invest at different levels.
And the goal is to raise money for the campaign so you can give money back to female-led startups.
Absolutely. Yes, 20 female-led startups throughout Chicago and the Midwest, so we'll be putting together an investment committee of leading diverse professionals throughout Chicago, of course, coming from the perspective of how women like to work together and how we invest in our money, and we'll make those impacts in those organizations.
You know, I have so many different people on the program, and we talk about the tech industry here. We talk about the startup scene. Mm-hmm. Howard Tolman from 1871 talked not too long ago about how the industry is a major part of the Chicago economy.
Right.
How has it moved? I mean, for both of you, I mean, how has Chicago moved? I mean, when we see these great things about the numbers and the fact that there's a whole industry that's created here, especially around technology, those issues that we're talking about for women in the business, have they gotten any better, or is this just the tip of the iceberg and we need to know more?
They have not gotten any better for women. I mean, if you consider that women are getting $2.90 for every 100 a man has gotten, and that isn't moving right now, and that's one of the reasons why we want to launch the 1920 campaign, because we want to change that number, and we want women to have access.
The only reason I ask is it's a kind of a new industry. You know, so
that's,
it's like,
right,
you could right the wrongs of the past. You can right the wrongs of, you can't say, yeah, about the tech industry in Chicago, well, you know, it started back in the 50s.
That's right.
It's new. So the fact that it's already started with rampant sexism is not a good start.
No.
It's not a great start, but I think, you know, change takes time. I do think we can give credit to Chicago for a lot of the female-focused initiatives that are out there, but the reality is there's decisions to make those investments still happen behind the same closed doors, and that's where change has to really happen, and there has to be a higher level of accountability. It is a new industry, but a lot of the people who have the capacity or feel that they have the capacity to become angel investors, they still play an old boys game.
Yeah.
And what's interesting right now in Chicago, there's a very successful female entrepreneur. She's going out. She's trying to raise $750,000. She's pregnant. The question she gets is, can you be a mother and be the CEO? Now, they're not asking any man who's going to be a dad.
No, no.
Can you be a dad and still be the CEO?
And here's the way that women look at that, right? If we have more female funders out there, that female funder says, you know what, not only do I know you can do it, but I know that you'll be a better quality leader for not only being a mom, but also understanding the values and needs of your kids and your community, and the fact that you founded this company.
Yeah,
that means you're a better quality leader.
Well, the campaign that just started is the 1920 Vote Your Money campaign. You can find all this at the website.
Yeah, Dymond, D-Y-M-Y-N-D .com.
CEO Carolyn Leonard and Chief Strategy Officer Monica Black in studio with Dymond. Thanks you so much for being
Thank
my guest
you.
Tonight. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you know, the big rains this fall once again brought up the glaring infrastructure needs right here in town in Chicago. The rain forced the Chicago River to reverse itself, dumping sewage in the lake and into our drinking water. This issue is one that can be considered an anomaly, but if it wasn't happening at an alarming rate. Climate change is real and it's posing severe threats, not just to Chicago, but the Midwest. Whether it's rainwater, sewage, flooding, or even superstorms, Chicago's going to need to think outside the box a bit about the future of our area. Tonight, my guest, Henry Henderson. Currently, he's the director of Midwest programs for the National Resource Defense Council. And if his name sounds familiar, it's because Henderson was the very first environment commissioner here in the city of Chicago under Mayor Daley. He served in the Attorney General's office in the state of Illinois. He taught law and environmental policy at the University of Chicago. And in his new capacity, he oversees seven Midwest states for the NRDC. Who better to know what we have and what needs to be updated than Henry Henderson, my guest at the big table. Mr. Henderson, great to see you.
Oh, it's great to see you. Real pleasure.
I've had Josh on a couple of times, and we've talked a lot about environment on the show. And I love to have you in studio because I remember working with you when you were the first environment commissioner.
Right.
When we see stories like this, when we see the fall rains, and just recently, like in the last couple of months, when that torrential rain came through on that Saturday, and just it was an amazing amount of rainfall.
Huge.
It is having repercussions on not just, you know, what happens with our river and the fun science behind it, but the fact that it's pouring things that shouldn't be in our fresh water and putting it in our fresh water.
Yeah, well, it's a quality of life thing. It's a public safety thing. It's an economic thing. I mean, the realities are that it affects people where they live. It affects people's basements. It affects what they can do in the summer on the beaches.
Right.
And there are large implications with regard to how we earn a living and how we're going to be able to continue to invest and stay in this region.
Well, I always think about it because, you know, we always seem to marvel at the wonder that was us reversing the Chicago River at one point, the engineering feat.
Pretty audacious.
Right. They say we're just going to reverse the flow of water.
Yeah.
And as the climate change continues to change to how much rain comes down and how fast it comes down and all things, it's not necessarily the greatest thing that we reverse the river.
Well, no. And, people in Peoria, St. Louis, the fact that it sends it down to the Gulf of Mexico, and it's one of the largest sources of pollutants that are going into the Gulf of Mexico, creating the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, when you mess around with this kind of stuff, there are unintended consequences. But where we are now, you know, assessing where we are, it's a huge investment that was made here over a century ago in audacious infrastructure. And one of the things we ought to be seeing is, can we seize that kind of like visionary audacity to change the way we're investing today to meet the needs of today?
I mean, do you see an infrastructure project like that where we came together in a city that works and decided to reverse the river? Do you see that kind of will, political will or any other municipal will to make a big project like that happen in 2017, 2018, 2020?
Well, there are parts of the world that are making big investments like this. Like China, for instance, is building an amazing amount of infrastructure and putting a huge amount of changes in transportation, water, et cetera, in order to deal with current problems and projected future problems. We have a lot of problems in the United States coming together around these sorts of issues. There are things that can be done and can be done immediately, like the green infrastructure approach, where you capture the rainwater and treat it as a resource as opposed to a waste disposal problem. Our current system treats it as a waste disposal problem.
Right.
So it shoves it into combined sewers. The combined sewers overflow, floods basements, then dumps highly contaminated water into the river. And as we can see with the reversal of the river going into the lake, which is our source of drinking water, which is why we reversed the Chicago River to begin with, to stop putting that stuff into where we'd get our drinking water.
You know, with you at the NRDC, but others, I mean, when I think about the EPA or I think about the municipalities, the mayors, the governors, the people in the regions that you serve, the seven states, are they aware? Is this something that's becoming higher on the priority list, that this old infrastructure projects, particularly with the Chicago River, is wreaking havoc everywhere?
Well, there's an awareness within the Great Lakes Basin that the Chicago River situation is problematic. It's driven largely by the problem of invasive species and the so-called, you know, crisis around the Asian carp and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other Great Lakes states have a severe concern about that and what it would do to the ecosystem and the economy we have in the Great Lakes if this amazing invasive species gets into the lake, and it is a serious infrastructure issue. There are a lot of the states are looking at these issues in terms of how we deal with water infrastructure. It is very much at the lower level of infrastructure thinking, though. It's like, how do you do these rain gardens? How do you do things like green roofs, et cetera, that slow the movement of water into our sewer system and keeps it from overflowing? That's a really important thing, right. And it can get things done. But it's not transformative in terms of our wastewater system is based upon simply collecting as much of this as possible, mixing it with sewage, and then sending it elsewhere.
Yeah, that seems
like,
to be
down to the Gulf of Mexico, to St. Louis, et cetera.
Right.
As opposed to how do we really rethink this, and how do we approach something like our current combined sewer system? Can we redo that? Can we re-engineer that? There are communities in our region which have been doing that, but in Chicago itself, it's a gigantic issue. And that needs the engineering thinking and economic review of that needs to happen.
And obviously, that's the big part of it, the economic review. And we talk about where we're at as a city and even a region. We talk about how taxed out, no pun intended, you know, the, everything is. Henry Henderson is my guest. He's the director of the Midwest Programs for National Resource Defense Council, was also the first environment commissioner for the city of Chicago under Mayor Daley. Let's take a break and let's talk about that. Because
sounds good.
You have a chance. You've been in both places. You understand what it takes to actually think outside the box when it comes to environmental issues and also how to figure out how to pay for them. That's really going to be the issue. Henry Henderson, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. My guest at the big table, Henry Henderson, the first ever environment commissioner for the city of Chicago. That was under Mayor Daley in the 90s. He's now the director of Midwest Programs for the NRDC. He serves seven Midwest states, and we're talking about the issues of environment and also infrastructure, but also how we're going to pay for all this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it does seem at the end of the day that we all come together, community, municipalities, even citizens, to say, yeah, we can't be dumping sewage into the lake water.
No.
But the concept of how to fix that, when you put that price tag on it and you go to any citizen in the city of Chicago and say, you know what, we're going to have to raise your taxes to do this. They're going to say, I'm okay with a little sewage in my... How do you find a way to convince people that these projects that cost a lot of money need to be done?
Yeah. Well, I think there are ways to begin in a sensible way where you're making an investment that actually protects people's property. For instance, when you get these huge storms that utterly predicted by climate scientists that this would happen, unprecedented amounts of rain falling in a very short time period, and our system is not built around that. So you get flooding of the system. It backs up into people's basements. We've got a lot of people whose basements repeatedly flood.
Yeah.
And this is a health issue, but it's also an economic issue.
We saw this along the Fox River. We saw it in Elgin, other places this summer.
You see it on the northwest side of Chicago. You see it on the south side. It's something that creates a real economic burden. Can we be doing things now that shave off the possibility of people getting their basements flooded and sewage going to their lakes and them not being able to go to the beach and, you know, the longer-term problem of cumulative input of contaminants that could affect our drinking water. These are big issues. But we also need to be looking at the fact that there actually are a fair amount of dollars going into infrastructure, and are they being used intelligently? There's a whole important set of programs on the federal side which are revolving loan funds that are funded by the federal government.
Right.
A lot of the thinking around that is simply how do we do the same thing we've done before? The fact is there's a fair amount of money that comes through that, and we've been doing analysis of these revolving loan funds, which deal with both drinking water and with sewage, and can they be used to actually have a backstop in a way to leverage further loans and to actually be doing, you know, intelligent long-term
kind of
funding.
So a lot of it is a thought. And I want to get into that because when you came in and Mayor Daley determined that we needed an environment commissioner, we needed an environment department, were these the same issues that were being talked about in the mid-90s or, you know, where you start to go, oh, we need to change the reversal of the river. We got to think about sewage. We got to think about flooding in the rivers. I mean, were these the same things in that office that we're discussing in 2017?
When we began the Department of Environment, the big problem was significant criminal assault on our communities through illegal dumping. You remember the Silver Shovel, shocking thing with hundreds of thousands of tons of debris being dumped in the middle of communities with impunity. And we needed to deal with those issues. So set of enforcement and, transformation of how we go about dealing with these issues and getting community input into what happens in their own communities was a big deal. But as we got a handle on that, and a number of people went to jail, and, you know, it focused the imagination admirably for a whole lot of people. That was very important. But, you know, the mayor started thinking a great deal about what's with the river. His father was big on the river. You know, he had this whole vision of how do you go down and fish in the river? How do you do a whole range of things? That this is a backyard that is, again, part of the thinking of the current administration. So there was a lot of thinking about that, and Mayor Daley actually came to this conclusion that because of a lot of problems with the river, we ought to rethink the reversal. So there has been a lot of thinking about this. The economics, as you say, are a big problem, in addition to which a commitment to the status quo is another big problem. You know, and if you look at the Chicago River, it is an adjunct to the sewer system. It is used to dump sewage but move it away from the lake. As we can see now with these huge storms, that is no longer infrastructure that's performing. So we have an inducement to seriously rethink this from a health point of view and from an economic point of view.
It kind of blows my mind to think that, you know, whenever that was, when the mayor's talking about, I really want to rethink the reversal of the river, to where we're at now is a couple decades. I think about that. There are a lot of environmental concerns that are on the minds of the leaders of this area, but because of resources, because of economic viability, because you have to buck the trends and the lot and everyone that wants it to stay the status quo, it's very difficult politically to make any changes when it comes to the environment.
It is, but I think we've got two things here. We're talking about adaptation to deal with changed circumstances. So, you know, how do we adapt to the realities that are confronting us today? We have a lot of information, a lot of experience,
right,
that the status quo is not performing. How do we start changing that thinking? We've got the other piece, which is mitigation, which is how do we stop the drivers that are turbocharging these changes, that are making the climate is changing, the weather is changing, the infrastructure we're living with today is not fit for the current situation. How do we dial that back? There's actually been a fair amount, and I think really good news in the Midwest. In Chicago, you've got the Mayor Rahm Emanuel is convening this large symposium and a summit of cities from around the world to talk about these issues, both adaptation and mitigation. Cities leading because they're actually the frontline communities which are feeling it the most. So there's a lot to be said about the creativity and the commitment of a lot of our municipal leaders, you know, and Mayor Emanuel has committed to the Paris Climate Accords. Mm-hmm. The only nation on Earth that is withdrawing from that is the United States. At a time when we're experiencing unambiguously these issues with storms, with fires, with hurricanes that are devastating.
But you and I both know, because, you know, we've talked about environment. You've obviously lived it. I've talked about it for years. The Paris Accord, there's political ideology at play.
Well, yeah.
And the idea that how much the United States really needs to fit the bill for other countries to be able to take on issues around coal or issues around pollution. And that essentially is when you think of the Republican administration now, they don't want to fit the bill. Far too often we get into the conversations where you hear they actually want to keep the environment the way it is. But it's not necessarily that case. It again comes down to money in the way that, I don't know, there's something about the way that municipalities and our government, our federal government, wants to spend money that is not really in line with how fast we have to spend it, if that makes sense.
Well, I think there's a great deal of truth to that. You know, it's that we just had the EPA under this administration releasing a report saying climate change is rapidly moving forward well beyond our worst-case scenario.
Right.
And it has all these manifestations from the experience with these amazing hurricanes, which have, you know, rendered basically Puerto Rico absolutely no clean water to drink, no energy. You've got serious problems in Houston. I mean, you know, the American people are suffering in these in large parts of the country because of the turbocharging of climate change to these natural disasters. So where does the leadership come from? And there's a lot to be said about, you know, getting outside of the ideological pieces.
Right, right.
The Midwest, for instance, there was hugely important legislation passed the last year on climate change and clean energy in Michigan, unambiguously dominated by Republicans on the state level, and yet the state level embraced it.
Right, they recognize what's
happening.
And
they see it as, you know, it's also an embrace of an economic future. There are now 2.2 million people working in energy efficiency in the United States today. That is a lot of people. It supports a huge amount of businesses. There is an economic case to be made about responding to these challenges. You've got the city of Chicago. It's part of the City Energy Project, which includes 40 cities in the United States, where you're retrofitting all these buildings downtown Chicago. What does that do? You don't pick up a building and send it to China to get retrofit. You've got identifiable trades. You've got identifiable manufacturers. You've got identifiable workers who have significant, important, long-term jobs doing this kind of thing. And that benefits the economics of running the building. And it creates a local economy that's much more viable.
Henry Henderson, my guest tonight at the big table. He's the director of the Midwest Program for the National Resource Defense Council. He represents seven different Midwest states for the NRDC, also the former first ever environment commissioner for the city of Chicago under Mayor Daley. All right, we'll take a quick break, come back, and we'll continue our conversation with Henry here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Henry Henderson, longtime environmentalist, but first ever environment commissioner for the city of Chicago under Richard M. Daley. Also, he is the director of the Midwest Program for the National Resource Defense Council. He represents seven different Midwest states. You know, we're talking about environment because a symposium's coming up here in Chicago, and it seems that Chicago, like other big cities in this country, are taking a lead. They're almost separating themselves from the federal government and ideology to say, listen, we're going to continue where we're going. The question on the table, and the reason that I have you here, because and of course, you know, you're a charming guy. But I'm intrigued on how, from your vantage point, from being the first ever environment commissioner, how you convince a citizen and also a government, as well as an industry, that change has to happen. That there needs to be money, priority, commitment, and responsibility, I think, from communities, that climate change is real, it's there.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, there are a range of things that you can take a part on that. For instance, I mentioned in Michigan, very important clean energy legislation passed last year. In Illinois, there's the Future Energy Jobs Act, which was passed by the General Assembly and signed by the governor, which brought together this huge coalition of businesses, of activists, of unions, and citizens to pass this, because there's an agreement, not necessarily full-on agreement about the nature of climate change, but that the solution set, i.e. investment in clean energy, was the way forward in the future. And among the things that need to happen, it's not just like built infrastructure like combined sewers that don't get the job done. There's legal infrastructure where the definition of how you make a living, for instance, the utilities, Commonwealth Edison, the original infrastructure for their making money was selling more and more and more and more energy, which meant building more and more coal plants at the time.
Right.
Changing the way you can earn money as a utility by full energy services, which includes investing in retrofitting buildings. So you aren't selling as much energy, but you get a return on your investment of driving down the use of energy, so that the huge waste of energy in the United States today is going down, down, down because of changing the business model of utilities. You can make money by doing clean energy choices.
Does that need to be a marketing campaign to people?
It's multiple things. I think, Justin, it's you've got the broad-based campaigns about, you know, what our problems are, what our solutions are, how do you dial it down into the actual experience of real people. The issue of climate change is remarkably abstract, but if you're talking about the flooding of your basement, the loss of the value of your home, not being, you know, metaphorically but actually literally underwater, and what that means in terms of the disruption of your life and your major asset
right.
in life.
People get that.
It matters. I mean, it really matters. And you know, there was an interesting thing about a family on the South Side. It's like the third generation living in this house, which they've been very happy with. But in the last 5 years, the basement has flooded repeatedly, and the cost and disruption is remarkable. And that's literally making climate change come home. So there's a lot of discussion, a lot of broad-based campaign, but also retailing information that is really critically important.
I always think about the role of government when it comes to environment and climate change. And even in your time when you were at the Environment Department, you had one side which was policing in a way to say that the corporate polluters and what we saw with Silver Shovel, but and it's still an issue when you see the plants that are along in the southeast side there. And then on the other side, you had, you know, making sure that the infrastructure is up to date, sewage, pipes, other things that are so we're not wasting water, all that kind of stuff, right? But is there a third element? You see this a little bit more in states that are more at risk. California, for example. You can only use water on certain days to water your plants.
Right.
And I think about other municipalities where they start to get into regulating your use of natural resources.
Yeah.
Do you see that as that is what governments have to do in 2017? Do we have to come in and say, the law is you have to recycle? The law is if you can take a 15-minute shower, whatever it is. You know, I don't know what the law might be, but do you see a future in which that is how we live?
I certainly hope that the transformation of habits that are no longer sustainable don't become a question of policing across the board. I mean, something like, you know, taking a hot shower for a particular period of time is an utterly different set of realities than putting 700,000 tons of waste in the middle of a community.
Sure.
That, you know, with a $23 million cleanup. I mean, you don't want to get into this nanny state thing. There's actually a way in which people transform the way they live, the way they operate, et cetera. There's an interesting, Jane Addams, she did this very interesting book about living at Hull House. And there are about three chapters in there about waste management and how it was being managed at the time when she was, you know, beginning Hull House. Wow. And then what is the system that allows the buildup of 10 feet of garbage in our alleyways where children play and the community she was working in? And how do you approach the city council? How do you identify heroes and champions? How do you work away patiently but determinedly over a period of time and transform the way things were? And she got herself elected to a solid waste board, you know, that helped change that. It's steady damn work is what it is. You've got to identify a series of really clear goals. You've got to identify the constituencies that matter. And you've got to figure out different ways to approach them, because the status quo is one of the easiest things to be comfortable with.
Right.
And that's part of what we're looking at with regard to wastewater in the city of Chicago. It's like the status quo, which is you look at the river as essentially an adjunct to the sewer system, which the previous Water Reclamation District chief engineer used to say, this is not the waters of the United States. This is part of a sewer. Okay. So how can you be, that's no longer the position of MWRD down the street from here, and they're interested in transforming the way they do things around this. But at a time, it was like, this is the status quo. This is what I've inherited, and that's how I should treat it. Why are you criticizing?
It's always been done, right.
Why are you criticizing me? This was one of the great engineering feats of the world. We turned this into a part of a sewer system that sends our problem elsewhere. So, you know, it's steady work of why this is not sustainable. And there's a huge health issue here. There's a huge economic reality. The economic reality is somewhat invisible to a range of people. And it's part of our job to make that more visible.
But having you here to talk about your decades of work in trying to, whether it be at the municipality level, whether working in governments or working at NRDC, but this idea that, okay, you know what, you've 20-plus years since you were environment commissioner. It has been steady, but now we're in 2017 where hurricanes are wiping out things every other, and dude, rains are coming in like they were predicted to flood rivers. Is that going to be every summer? Is that going to be every fall the same way? Does steady have to turn to immediate? And,
yes.
And how do you do that politically?
Well, it's a huge thing. We say all the time, when we identify the fact that we are winning lots of battles. but we are not winning the war. And you know, the question is, can you win a war? Well, you can definitely change the terms, and you can establish a new set of practices and habits that are part of a public ethic. That's what we need to be doing.
Because I think about that. I think about we started this conversation talking about the audacious infrastructure plans for reversing the Chicago River. How big thinking do you have to be in 2017? I would assume we would be in a position where the mayor could come forward, or the governor, or the president, or anyone who's in a position of authority and deliver on an audacious plan to address climate change. It feels like the environment to do that is right.
Well, what I'm hoping is that after this summit that Mayor Emanuel is putting on, which has a lot of civic support, and you're bringing a lot of important mayors here, that you know, they will sign on to some very audacious plans. You know, and how do you put a price on carbon? How do you actually commit to? You know, most of these leaders have within their own jurisdiction transformation of their built infrastructure. So it's become much more efficient. They're committing to renewables. They're committing to a number of them to drinking water and wastewater infrastructure that is much more responsive to the threats we're facing today. So as you get leaders like this together, it can have a significant transformation because they don't have, as mayors, it's one of the pleasures of working on the city level, is you do not have the luxury of thinking simply ideologically. It's what's on this corner that's happening. What is happening within this neighborhood? How do the asthma rates relate to how our energy is produced, and how do property values relate to reliable of our energy grid and the reliability of our water, so that we're not drinking lead-infested water that creates all kinds of long-term irreversible impacts. So that's a lot of the thinking that's happening at the municipal level, and I think it's because of the closeness to real people and real issues.
We've heard a lot about green infrastructure. We've heard about the city hall having the garden on top.
Yeah.
The mayor's being progressive in the sense that they're looking for green technology, clean energy in the area. From your vantage point, as the first ever environment commissioner here in the city of Chicago, are we making strides? Is it in 20 years' time? Are you optimistic about where we are, not just as a government, but as a people in the Midwest?
I am surprisingly optimistic about the Midwest, which is, you know, one of the most energy-demanding parts of our economy. And it is a place where there are huge long-term and structural problems with the economy. And yet you've got the emergence of leaders on both sides of the aisle. You know, you've got progressive leadership of John Kasich, very conservative governor of Ohio, who is really committed to energy efficiency and clean water and sees this as a deeply ethical commitment. You've got interesting realities with these other states like Iowa, which is unambiguously a Republican state that is committed to renewable energy and understands this as part of the future economic reality, and it fades into, you know, a solution set. So I'm optimistic about it. I love I'm a Midwesterner. I love being in the center of the country, and I'm particularly, if you look at climate change and you refer to problems of California and lack of water, here we've got 95% of the available fresh water in the United States of America. If that doesn't focus the imagination to do the right thing by it.
Well, it also makes us lazy. That you're like, you know, a little sewage got in there, so what? There's so much of it. That's what I think. I'm not sure.
Well,
I feel like
so ludicrous. It's hard to believe. I mean, honest to God. I mean, you know, who wants to go swimming in or drink out of your toilet?
Yeah.
You know, and here we are at the bottom of Lake Michigan, where it's not like this stuff is circulated and gets out of our environment. It's like accumulating at the bottom of the lake here. So are we going to do the right thing? Are we going to who cares about whether BP refinery in Whiting is increasing the pollutant load? You know, there's just so much water out there. What kind of impact can that have? I mean, it's like it's not recognizing the human impact that is utterly transforming the environment that we depend upon. You know, we've moved to the what's now being called the Anthropocene part of the history of Earth, which is the human impact is pervasive, And if we don't get a handle on it, lazy is one of the least insults you can apply to that. I like that.
Henry Henderson, the director of the Midwest Programs for the National Resource Defense Council. He oversees seven Midwest states. He's also the former, first ever, Environment Commissioner for the City of Chicago back in the 90s under Mayor Daley. Henry, great to have you here.
This was a great gig.
Many more questions about that, but yeah, we'll do that another time. Thanks for being my guest, and I appreciate it.
I really appreciate you having me on, and this is such a wonderfully important set of questions, and I appreciate you getting into it, so thank you.
That's awesome that they created the Department of Environment, essentially, or commissioner, because of Silver Shovel. And you think about how much waste, industrial waste, they talked about tons of debris just thrown into communities in Chicago. But that, in a way, that was what needed to be dealt with in Chicago. That was the environment. You know, you're literally the environment we live in. And you'll hear over and over more stories about industry and neighborhoods and how they have to work around the idea of pollution, things like that. So you can understand why there's a need for it. But it's funny that in 2017, there's such a focus on bigger picture, bigger ticket items. The reversing of the Chicago River, sewage leaking into our drinking water. Not to mention the fact that infrastructure for flooding along the rivers or possible natural disasters, it's going to cost money. Interesting. So I have to say I think it'll be a big story. I think it starts next Monday. The mayors from all over the country, they're already coming out. There was, a New Jersey mayor, governor maybe? Who's the New Jersey governor? It's not Chris Christie anymore, right? Or is he still? No, he's not. I'm sorry, I'm not up on my New Jersey politics. Governor, mayor, one of the cities there, came out today essentially calling for the resignation of Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, citing rollbacks. So I think there's going to be a pretty robust and volatile discussion in Chicago next week. Big city mayors. I think there's hundreds of people coming to Chicago. So hopefully there'll be a Bulls game they can go to. This is where Michael Jordan played for a couple seasons. Popcorn? You want popcorn? We've got chicken strips too. Don't focus so much about what's happening on the court. Look at the banners. Look at the rafters. Look at how many banners are up there. All right, coming up, we'll talk about basketball that means something to Chicago right now. High school basketball getting underway. The Chicago Elite Classic shootout will be at the UIC Pavilion. We're going to talk with two esteemed legendary coaches in high school basketball public league lore. Robert Smith, the coach at Simeon, Coach Derek Rose, Jabari Parker, Tyrone Slaughter at Whitney Young, Coach Jaleel Okafor. Last year, these two coaches met in the 4A championship, Whitney Young with the upset. This year, both ranked in the top five again, both ranked nationally. It's amazing to think about Chicago high schools playing, and you know, constantly these two high schools in the top 25. These two coaches have 9 state championships between them.
How's McHenry? Are they a basketball powerhouse?
Yeah, not as much. Yeah,
Fox Lake area.
I don't know. I went to one game, maybe. Realized, it's too hot in here. Never paid attention to the McHenry Warriors basketball team. They were never good, but had a chance. The football team was always good. Basketball, maybe, and it could have changed. Maybe they're outstanding team right now. I don't know. Maybe they're power. Maybe the power of the Fox Valley. Couldn't tell you. Also coming up, Bob Garfield's going to join us. He is the co-host of On the Media, great nationally syndicated public radio program that talks about all things media. Big day to talk to him. He's coming to the Park West next week with his one-man show, Ruggedly Jewish. Talk with Bob Garfield. It's awesome to have him on. Perfect day. I only want to talk about Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor, but I also want to talk about Project Veritas, what happened earlier about I think it was Monday, right? That kind of launched, maybe yesterday. It's all blending together. But just the story of what the media needs to do to safeguard against this onslaught of hashtag fake news. especially when there are organizations out there actively advocating to trip them up. Talk with Bob Garfield about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then Half Gringa, the great rural rowdy rock band, will be in Studio 435 tonight. Lots to do. Let's do it. Thanks, Rob. It is a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in a little bit, we're going to talk with two legendary high school basketball coaches here in Chicago, from Whitney Young, Tyrone Slaughter, and from Simeon High School, Robert Smith. Between them, 9 state champions. They'll be at the Chicago Elite Classic coming up at the UIC Pavilion this weekend. We'll talk with them about readying their student-athletes, not just for life on the court, but life off the court. So we'll talk with both of the coaches coming up after the 9:30 news. Well, what a week for media stories. Today, of course, the firings of both Matt Lauer at NBC and Garrison Keillor at NPR, Minnesota Public Radio, over sexual harassment allegations grabbed everyone's attention. Those stories are just the latest in bombshells that have hit the media industry. Add to the story of Project Veritas and the attempts to trick Washington Post reporters into a fake story about Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, and you'd say this has been a banner week for media. My guest tonight can be heard on Public Radio's On the Media, the nationally syndicated radio program that comes out of WNYC, is one of the best around. It's co-hosted by Brooke Gladstone, and my guest tonight, Bob Garfield. Garfield, longtime journalist and commentator, is going to be at the Park West next Saturday night, December 9th, with his show Ruggedly Jewish, an evening with Bob Garfield. Bob Garfield, welcome to the download.
Well, thank you, Justin.
So I know you as a – I love On the Media. I've always been a fan of the show. I've known you as a commentator and a journalist. I haven't known you as much as a one-man show performer. Talk about where this idea comes from to do this show, Ruggedly Jewish.
Well, I grant you that my one-man show resume is a little thin. It's limited to the one. But it comes from a lifetime of experience as my fraught relationship with my own religion, with weirdly enough, my 15 or 20 years on the road for the All Things Considered show on NPR, where I traveled the countryside looking for American eccentrics who, it turned out, had some connective tissue there. They had something in common, which it took me a while to discover. That thing that they had in common was they were trying to improve themselves according to their notion of the American dream, and find their identity via self-improvement. And there were a lot of harebrained schemes to do just that, which I found amusing at the time, but also ultimately quite revealing. And, also the country is in the middle of its own sort of search for identity, and as expressed in identity politics of various stripes, and most particularly the rise of the alt-right, which I think can be credited to a decades-long sense of having lost their American identity, or what their perception is of what being American was all about. Mm-hmm. And those of all of those elements are, I don't know if you ever went to camp and made lanyards out of GIMP, GIMP?
Sure.
Well, I take 4 or 5 pieces of GIMP and I weave them together, and Ruggedly Jewish is, well, it's a lanyard, Justin. It's a multimedia lanyard with dead cats and live cats and gunplay and singing and dancing, a whole mess of weird stories, some very harrowing moments, some ugly glimpses of fascism, and why, you just name it.
Well, Bob, it's interesting because I always think, people might think, because you perform on the media, you're a broadcaster, commentator, analyst, you've done this forever, you've had a life in telling stories, that it'd be an easy transition to the stage, is it?
Yeah, that's kind of like, yeah, you have cut down a little birch tree in your backyard with a chainsaw, so it's easy to juggle 6 of them. It isn't easy to juggle 6 chainsaws. It's really an experience. I've been a critic for most of my career, including criticism of acting as a movie and an advertising critic, and I think I'm pretty astute at figuring out how not to do it. It turns out that's a different set of skills than knowing how to do it. And while I am, I guess, a natural performer, I have no experience on the stage, and I, you know, truthfully don't know what I'm doing, and I'm blundering my way through. But you know, the audiences so far seem to be pretty satisfied because it's an unusual theater evening. Let me put it to you that way.
Bob Garfield, Ruggedly Jewish, An Evening with Bob Garfield will be next Saturday night at the Park West. Garfield, of course, the co-host of On the Media, as well as a longtime journalist and commentator, critic as well. Yeah, I'm glad to have you tonight. I mean, it's amazing to have someone of your caliber to talk about the media because so much is happening. I wanted to get your thoughts on the stories today, Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor. With the onslaught from the White House in terms of, you know, the hashtag fake news and the already kind of reputation that the media has with middle America, you get to see the polls that come out and people always talk about the media being lower down at the bottom by trial lawyers. What do these kind of stories, when it comes to abuse of power, sexual harassment, things of these nature, do for the reputation of the media in general?
I don't think it's that big of an issue. The media have a bad reputation. I make a living actually documenting the things the media organizations actually do wrong. And then there is this whole series of myths that the political right likes to trade in about what they perceive the media to be doing wrong, like inventing stories out of whole cloth and unfairly criticizing the president and having some sort of anti-American agenda, all of which is baloney. One thing I can say about this moment is I think I would draw the opposite conclusion, and that is while the America is bitterly divided, such as never before, I think in close to a century, the one thing that brings us all together is that a liberal Y chromosomes and conservative Y chromosomes all behave the same. And their predatory behavior among powerful men knows no political party, and it knows no ideology. It's an equal opportunity grotesquerie. And the reason that so many media people have been in the news is because it started, I guess, with Harvey Weinstein, this whole avalanche. And so it's naturally that the women in media are more emboldened than others to come forward. But I am as certain of this as I've ever been certain of anything, and that is that this touches absolutely every industry, absolutely every walk of life. And, you know, it's not just high name recognition, powerful big shots. It's completely anonymous, local big shots and tavern owners and fast food managers and everyone in between. Because this isn't about media. This is about male abuse of power and unbridled sexual impulses. It's when, you know, I don't want to get too much of a sermon here, but I think what it breaks down to is that men are beasts and civilization is supposed to moderate people's behavior. And whatever, you know, sort of primal instincts you have, civilization is supposed to make you to respect people so we can all, you know, live together in the same world. But what we clearly know now is that men in high positions are very bad at the civilized part.
Well, today's stories, of course, with Matt Lauer and with Garrison Keillor, kind of take the pressure a little bit off of what we saw earlier this week from Project Veritas and this idea of trying to – this gotcha organization that's trying to trick the Washington Post into reporting fake news, the reason being to show that they're biased, but at the same time possibly to confuse and disorient or cloud the serious allegations that are against Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore. This was amazing. I've seen a lot of stuff on Twitter in the last couple of days just about
whether or not this kind of journalism, the showing how the sausage is made, the Washington Post coming forward, writing the story, showing how they fact check, showing how they go through a story and weed out when something like this comes through. Is this a good thing for the media, or is this something that is more sort of shoegazing or not necessarily what people want to read?
Well, is it a good thing for the media? Sure, it's better that media using due diligence and the basic reporting techniques that they bring to bear on, you know, almost all of the stories that they do, are able to uncover scoundrels like Project Veritas's attempt to ensnare them into a dirty trick trap. Now, this organization is a right-wing group that under false pretenses gets and using false identities and false stories, gets interviews with people in the media, and then either gets them to say self-indicting things or not, but in any case, takes the tape and moves it around, manipulates it, cuts it, rearranges it to create the worst possible impression, but ultimately just big fat lies. They are liars, ironically. Project Veritas, which is Latin for truth, their goal is to show that the mainstream media are deceitful and liars and have an agenda, but their tactics are to lie themselves. And to the extent that is news to anybody, that's great. But most of the people who are their audience, Project Veritas's, are simply, you know, they've already made up their minds. They subscribe to an ideology that only works if the media are liars, and the president tells them that every day. The media are not liars. They make mistakes, thank God, or I would have no way to make a living. But whatever this disgrace of a president has to say, there is no there is the only fake news is coming out of social media scoundrels and Russian plants.
Well, Bob, let me ask you as we're wrapping up here, but I'm interested in whether or not this might have to be the way that the Washington Post and New York Times and other places who have been writing about these things and running into people like James O'Keefe and Project Veritas. Do you see a future in which the media is more transparent with how they gather their material, how they gather their stories, to essentially cover their tracks for if they are in a situation where they're tricked by Veritas or something like that?
Well, I think we have the technology now to be more transparent, but you know, we our job is to find out information and distill it in the most palatable way, not to sort of share all of our files. And which is, you know, it's a pretty onerous burden, and probably more distracting than helpful. And I don't think, although this was a delicious episode of the Washington Post trapping people trying to trap them, I hope that with a lot going on in the world, much of it horrible, that we don't have to spend a lot of time devoted to avoiding stings from right-wing bad guys, and that we can, you know, do the job that our audience pays us to do, which is to find out what's going on, to hold the government accountable, to answer questions that the public otherwise couldn't get answered, and to contextualize events that are sometimes very confusing. And every minute that we spend fending off politically motivated tricksters is, you know, kind of a waste of resources.
Yeah. Bob Garfield is coming to Chicago with his show December 9th, Saturday night at Park West. It's called Ruggedly Jewish, an evening with Bob Garfield. He's also the co-host of On the Media, great show on public radio that airs out of WNYC in New York. Bob, can't thank you enough for coming on the program. I appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
And in the spirit of transparency, Justin, there are no actual chainsaws in Ruggedly Jewish.
Good. Good. Thanks. Thank you for the disclosure. We appreciate it. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. All right, we shift from media to high school basketball. The season's underway. Preseason rankings to Simeon and Whitney Young high up on the leaderboard. Both coaches will be in studio. The Chicago Elite Classic comes to the UIC Pavilion this week, Friday and Saturday.
talk with them both about their seasons, but also about their jobs as coaches for two premier programs, but also programs like Simeon that have a lot of kids from the south side of Chicago that choose basketball over something else. So we'll talk with both the coaches coming up here on The Download. Yeah. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. This weekend, high school basketball takes over the UIC Pavilion. The Chicago Elite Classic is a shootout that features not only the best teams in the city and state, but brings in some of the best from around the country. 15 locally ranked schools and 5 nationally ranked will participate, including schools from Kansas, Missouri, South Carolina, and Indiana. It's become one of the preeminent high school basketball events in the United States and has now featured players like Jabari Parker and Jahlil Okafor, both playing in the NBA. It's co-hosted by two Chicago powerhouses, Whitney Young and Simeon High Schools, both schools ranked both locally and nationally. The Sun-Times put out their preseason rankings last week. Simeon was number one, and Young, the defending champs in the 4A, were number four. Simeon is coached by legend Rob Smith and Young by Tyrone Slaughter. These two coaches have 9 state championships between them. Oh, did I mention that Young beat Simeon last year for the 4A crown? Did I leave that part out?
No, that was perfect.
Coach Slaughter, Coach Smith in studio with me now. Thanks for being here, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
So let's talk about the Chicago Elite Classic. You guys have been doing this for a couple of years now. Talk about this shootout and what makes it so special.
It's growing. That's the most important thing. And just bringing it to Chicago and letting the fans be able to see some out-of-town teams playing and some of those out-of-town teams coming to Chicago and seeing our beautiful city and not just our basketball. And this thing is not just about basketball.
It's about showcasing Chicago at a different level, maybe giving people a different understanding of what the city is.
You know, when we look at it, we talked about it from a couple of different standpoints. We've actually incorporated some things within the city for the event that don't have really anything to do, quote unquote, with basketball. We have workshops for our young people where we bring them in and we talk about financial literacy. We talk about building your brand. We talk about how to be good citizens. And we have what we call our Champions in Life program. So from a basketball standpoint, basketball is kind of the hook by which we grab these young people. And then we kind of surround them with a lot of different things. And on Saturday before our game, we'll have a breakfast that will be all of our teams will attend, and they'll be addressed by some greats. In the past, we've had John Rogers from Aerial Capital. You know, we've had Arnie Duncan, the former education secretary. You know, we've had some phenomenal people that have spoken to our young people to kind of show them that basketball, albeit a great sport, it's not the end-all to be-all. It actually, there's more to it than just basketball. And then our kids have an opportunity to see a great city. They stay downtown in the Hyatt Regency, and our out-of-town teams get an opportunity to see Chicago in a dramatically different light than what they may read about and hear about in the news.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because there will be basketball and good basketball, and it's interesting how high school basketball has, if you think about the college teams here in Chicago, not necessarily the best we've seen in all the teams that have come through Chicago and played in, over the years. High school basketball has always been constant, especially your two programs in the last couple decades. This idea of having a classic, a Chicago Elite Classic, to bring in nationally ranked teams from other parts of the country, does that help schools like Whitney Young, schools like Simeon get better recognition on the national level?
Well, it helps all the teams that's involved. You know, we had elementary games as well, so those guys are playing as well. And then, you know, everybody wants to be in the classic now. It's a big hit for the public lead and Chicago basketball. And matter of fact, Illinois basketball, period. We have already teams that's calling to be in for next year, you know, so it's really big and it's grown. You know, when we first started this and we first was talking about it, we kind of envisioned it being really, really big. We didn't know how big, but I mean, it's taken off to another level at this point.
For the players, for the students that'll be a part of this, it's one thing to get them ready to play basketball. It's another to get them over the nervousness of playing in front of their student body. But it's another to get on the court at the USC Pavilion with all of the fans that will be there, all of the media access, just the concept that this is a national shootout. Do you have to do something different for your kids to get them ready to play with such spotlight on them?
No, I think the way most of us look at it, and myself and Coach Smith, we've had the fortune of being able to travel around the country for many years now. So our programs are pretty much accustomed to the level and the stage. A lot of the other teams, unfortunately, have not and do not travel, but that was another part of the reason we wanted to do it here, so that our kids would have an opportunity to get that exposure. And I think once the ball goes up and once you start playing as a competitor, as a basketball player, it becomes just basketball. You know, you kind of drown out the noise and all of the other accoutrements that are going on around mm-hmm. you and just play basketball. So that was a part of why we wanted to bring it here, because so many people have seen our teams in the past travel. Coach Smith has been on ESPN numerous times, as have we. And so people here see us and they think, oh, my God, we would love to do it. Unfortunately, they may not have had the opportunities. So what we did was we bought that event to Chicago, and it has been a stellar event going on 6 years now.
It's got to help, too, when you get ready for tournaments, whether you know you're going out down to Fort Myers or other places, but also to help when it gets to playoff time and you have to go the big lights and the big stage when it comes to the 4A championships. It's got to help the kids early on to have this experience.
Yeah, definitely. It puts you in that environment early. You know, it's for us, it's game one. And to step out that game one to play a great Chaminade team, and you know what you're saying with the big crowd and the big lights, it shows us early where we're at, you know, and where we can be at, and how far we can actually go, and it helps us for March, you know, when you're playing on a bigger court, you know, it helps us when we're in the city playoffs, when you go to play at Chicago State or if they have it at UIC, the guys are accustomed to it versus just playing in a regular high school gym. So it helps us out in many ways, but it's for the city. I mean, when we first talked about it, it was for our players to be able to be seen and some of the other schools to be seen, like you said, who cannot have these opportunities to go out. But it's for Chicago, and we just want to represent Chicago to the best of our ability and just let people see it in a different light. You know, they see all the negativity. They see it in the news, and they hear it on the radios, but we want to show them something totally different.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's take a quick break. In studio with me, Coach Rob Smith from Simeon and Whitney Young's Coach Tyrone Slaughter. Both schools are sponsoring the Chicago Elite Classic, the shootout, which is this weekend at the UIC Pavilions. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with coaches. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The Chicago Elite Classic coming to the UIC Pavilion this Friday and Saturday. It's going to take over the UIC Pavilion, bring the best of high school basketball, not just here in Chicago, but the state and the country. Two of the schools that will be sponsoring, Simeon and Whitney Young, both coaches in studio tonight. Legends, Coach Rob Smith at Simeon, Tyrone Slaughter at Whitney Young. You know, before the break, we talked about, you know, not only this being a shootout for the kids that are playing in the audiences and people who love basketball, but it's also this way to address some of the negative stereotypes and things that are happening in the city of Chicago. People come in to see a great shootout, but also get to see the city. Why is that important, especially when talk about the kids from Simeon? Why is it important for them to be able to see different parts of the city or for other people to see them in a different light?
Just because we get stereotyped so much. You know, they live in those communities where things are happening in that, and you know, they get stereotyped. So it's good just to see them out there, and it's refreshing when people can understand that they're normal 15, 16, 17-year-old kids. But it's so great for the outside people. That's who we're really targeting, the student-athletes who are coming in from out of town, because their voice or their opinion of it is all negative, because that's all they see. Mm-hmm. So to be downtown, to be able to see our beautiful city, you know, to be out on Michigan Avenue and it's Christmas time and all the lights and everything, it's just refreshing, you know, and they get a chance to see a different light of Chicago.
Both of you, as coaches of big schools here in high schools in the Chicago area, public league schools, how much is it those negative aspects that we're referring to, whether it be violence and poverty, inequality, those kind of things, playing out with your student body, playing out with your kids as kids who are escaping that to play basketball? How much of that is a reality that people don't think about?
Well, the unfortunate reality is it's a fact, and it's a fact, and it's a fact in the way of life for a lot of our young athletes and our young students, particularly in our inner city, that, you know, a lot of them, and I'm not saying necessarily the ones that are in our programs, fortunately, but for a large number of them, their choices. The choices, they can play sport, or they might do something else. And so many people look at us as coaches, and they see us as guys or people that just coach to win games. But invariably, what we're coaching to do is to win and to save lives. At the end of the day, in Chicago, now, this may not be the same at a different school or a different location, but in our inner city, the realities are that we lose black and brown boys and girls every single day to violence. And if we have other apparatuses and things for them to do, there's an opportunity for them not to be engaged in those kinds of issues. So our kids, we look at them as role models. They look at themselves as role models. And a lot of the people that support them from a fan perspective, they view them as role models. And these are young celebrities in Chicago that are athletes simply because they play a sport that people love. And so it's why we were fortunate. We have the mayor's involvement with the event. We have so many other different organizations, the Chicago Board of Education, Aerial Capital, a lot of these people who are stakeholders in what we're doing, because for two days, we can tell you where 7,000-8,000 people are. They're watching high school basketball. They're cheering. The only fight that's going on is between two opposition teams, and the fight ends with a handshake and a hug. It's not a shot. It's not a fight. It's not a physical fight, but that's the only battle, and people get to take sides. Yeah. And it's a fun time, and it's a family time.
You mentioned that about that they are role models. They are celebrities. I think about some of the players I even mentioned at the beginning of this interview, Jabari Parker, Jahlil Okafor, Derrick Rose falls in that category. As coaches, and you, when you are at schools like Simeon or Whitney Young, where there is basketball powerhouse, and these kids come in and they already kind of know, you know, they've got an apparatus around them that says, you know, we know exactly where you're going to go, where your career is heading. Does that make your job easier, harder, more challenging in the fact that you're dealing not just with a young kid, a 15, 16-year-old kid, but the fact that there's all this pressure around it?
Well, it's more kind of wrapping around what's going to happen at the end of this road, you know, because everybody's not going to make it. So for us as coaches, and our job is more as mentors, is trying to let them know that what are you going to do if this doesn't happen? You know, if you're not going to be a professional basketball player, you still have to go to college. You still have to get your degree. You still have to be able to take care of your family. So those are things that we preach every day. I know me and him talk about it, you know, when we just having general conversations like, hey, well, this kid is good, but, I mean, I saw Jabari play at this age, and he's nowhere like that. So it's a possibility that he may not make it, but yeah. He may be able to be a doctor. He may be able to be a lawyer. We just don't know. But we push that almost every day to them so they can understand those things, so it could be a reality as well, just in case I don't make it.
Yeah,
it is a challenge, and we work through it every day on trying to build our programs up to be the best in the country, and not just with basketball, but just, you know, role models.
There are a lot of schools in the state who don't have to deal with those kind of things. They don't have to deal with making sure that the student body is taken care of in that way. They're essentially there to be student athletes. They may get a scholarship out of it to go play in college, but at the end of the day, that's what they do. They're the college, or they're the high school basketball coach. In your case, I mean, you have to do so many more things. You have to be role models. You have to be mentors. You have to really think about making sure that, you know, guidance counselors in a way. Is that what you sign up for when you're coaching at Simeon or at Whitney Young?
I believe that's what you sign up for whenever you say that you're going to be a coach. It doesn't matter what the economic or geographic location is. If you choose to coach young people, most impressionable minds that we have, the future of our society, you have to do all those things. If anybody believes that coaching basketball is simply drawing up a play and running practice, they've never done it. You know, and I don't care what level you do it at or in, coaching is more. And for me and myself and for Rob and so many of my other brothers and sisters that coach in our inner city, coaching is some days it's going to turn to parenting. Some days it's going to turn to psychologist. Some days it's going to turn to being big brother. Whatever hat that day requires as a coach in our situation, it invariably causes you to be able to pivot. And that's why when I look at coaches, and we hear all the time about all the great coaches around the country and in our state, there are none that do it better than we do. And I say that because we deal with the least level of funding. You know, we have to fundraise and we have to do all those things. Then we have to deal with all the other issues that invariably come our way every single day, mm-hmm. From young people who come from single parenting homes that we invariably become surrogate fathers to or big brothers to. And yet we still are able to produce quality young people. And we're not talking about basketball players. We're talking about young people that go on to college, that go on to do great things in their lives. And invariably they come back to Simeon, to Whitney Young, to Curie, to Orr, to Julian, to Harlan, to all of our schools as a direct relationship because of the relationship that they have with their coaches.
You know, it makes me think about, to put on my sports page hat, and to say that, you know, all of the students that come through schools like Simeon or Whitney Young, to the amount of state championships together, I mean, six for you, Coach Smith, three for you, Coach Slaughter.
We don't have to keep saying six. Just say nine total.
Well, we can always throw in you beat him last year in the parade.
Okay, yeah, let's do
but
that.
It makes you wonder that more often than not that the kids in those situations, they're the sought-after talent. I mean, you'll see a lot of commitments to Division I schools, NCAA schools. People come here, other schools come here to colleges to mine for talent. Talk about that relationship and the idea that, you know, you have to make sure that they're not being taken advantage of, or if it's just this sort of, you know, someone coming in and doing a one and done, or things like that, or promising things that aren't going to come through. How active do you have to be when all of the college world is looking at your players?
It's hard, you know, because when you get a player like Jabari and you get a player like Derek, that's a different animal, because their family secured them so tight that nothing can get through. You know, they built their own team, their own wall up, and said, hey, this is what we're going to do, and these are the people that's going to be involved. For me, now, after having those guys, I kind of stepped myself back a little bit and let the parents deal with it, because it's their child. At the end of the day, they have to make the right decision for their family. I'm just a coach. I don't look for anything outside of coaching them and helping them get a high school diploma, and hopefully they go on to college and get a college degree, and them being productive citizens. That's what my job is. It's not to be running around Coach K and Roy Williams. They're not coming to get me. My time is up. I played my games. That's it. They don't need no more coaches. So I pretty much let the family handle it. And then I step in when they want me to step in and say what I think is good, what I think is bad, and what I think is a good fit for them. But at the end, it's their decision, because you never want somebody to say, well, hey, you the one told me to go to this school and it didn't work. Well, if you choose a school and it don't work, we're going to come back and sit down and find something that's going to work. So that's just my philosophy, and kind of staying back out of it, because, you know, it's so much going on now. You just don't want to be, you know, caught up in anything that could be negative.
So should we expect a 4A rematch?
No.
No?
No. And we
what do you – the rankings may suggest that.
But somebody else makes sure.
Somebody else make those decisions.
You guys – let me ask you this, though. Are you aware at how much Chicago loves high school basketball? I mean, are you aware of how much it runs in the blood? Where college, we of course, when there's a winning team, people go crazy for that. But there really is at the core this love for high school basketball.
That's why we do it.
Yeah.
We're some of those people. We're some of those junkies. You know, we're at games, and some games we're not scouting. We're just there because we love it so much as well. So when this is over, we'll still be going into gyms, watching games, and critiquing some other coaches like people critique us all the time and say, why he do this and why did he do that? But that love is there for us. That's why we do this. It's especially at, you know, working for where we work at and things like that. The money is definitely not the issue for us. That's, you know, we're not doing it for the money, because if we was, we'd definitely all be, we would have quit by now.
Well, if you want great basketball, the Chicago Elite Classic this Friday and Saturday, December 1st and 2nd at the UIC Pavilion, 15 locally ranked schools, including Whitney Young and Simeon, and, of course, nationally ranked schools from Kansas, Missouri, South Carolina, and Indiana. Like I said, it's at the UIC Pavilion. Both Simeon and Whitney Young are the sponsors. Legend, both in studio, 9 championships between them. Simeon's coach Rob Smith and Whitney Young's coach Tyrone Slaughter. Guys, can't thank you enough for being here.
You can get tickets at all the participating schools, Ticketmaster, and UIC box office.
And we thank you guys for having us, and we invite the entire city to come out and partake in some outstanding high school basketball at UIC Pavilion on Friday and Saturday. Thank you guys so much.
Chicago Elite Classic at the UIC Pavilion coming up on Friday and Saturday. I don't live that far from Whitney Young High School. I feel like I should be Pete. I should be the like the regular, you know, like the
creepy old guy hanging around the high school gymnasium.
That could be it. But I was thinking about, like, maybe I could be like the crazy orange wig.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe face paint, a little face paint.
Yeah.
Is that a high school basketball thing?
Rainbow wig.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. But it's just orange and blue for the Whitney Young Dolphins.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
But maybe I could do, if you go to the Chicago Elite Classic, I mean, Simeon is what? They're blue and yellow? Is that what they
are? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe I could do a rainbow wig that's blue, orange, blue, yellow.
Like both?
Yeah.
Like the old people that would have the White Sox and Cubs
right.
split hat.
I could be a Simeon Whitney Young guy.
I saw a guy walking down the street of Michigan Avenue when Northwestern was playing Purdue maybe a couple of weeks ago or something like that, mm-hmm. and he had like a half Northwestern, half Purdue hat and like a big sweatshirt that said, you know, proud dad of both or something like that.
When I went to that, game, the Northwestern Purdue game. You guys will like this. I was a little bit louder than I thought I should be. You know, I was making comments on each play, but I was sitting in a section with a lot of Purdue students, And I picked up quickly. These are young kids. They were like 18, 19 years old. Like really, because every time I said, good play, or something like that, they would look back and kind of disgust at me, right? And I realized it quickly that what was happening. So I was kind of having fun with them. Whenever there was any play that was in the favor of Northwestern, I went a little too far.
Yeah.
To the point of almost like slapping the kid on the shoulder, like, how you like that? And I realized that the best part of that story is I realized that when I went down to get popcorn, I came back up. We were sitting in the wrong seats.
Oh.
Like, I was in the wrong seat. So when I got to my normal seats, I was like, oh, but I'm not next to the Purdue kid. I can't razz him anymore. Yeah. He was pretty serious about it. He really got into his college football. I was doing our thing. Come on, quarterback, you're a bum. And he didn't get it. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tonight, a special Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer, right here in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. We gave Greg the swap meet a week off. Be back soon. Tonight, the folk rock sounds of Chicago's Half Gringa. Half Gringa is a songwriting project of Izzy Olive. The music has been classified as rowdy rural rock music. Love it. And her debut LP, Grunonia, came out this year. Half Gringa will be on stage at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee on Saturday night. And they're going to be at Shuba's here in Chicago on December 10th. But first, they're here in our studios. Izzy Olive and Sam Cantor of Half Gringa are here, and they're ready to perform the song Marte. Take it away, guys.
Green, 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 green grass, blue, 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 blue glass. Answer when I ask, are you coming back with scars? Fist fight, full armor. Aren't I a charmer? I don't feel any warmer. Am I coming back from Mars? Nothing, oh, and I suffer like it's nothing, and I take it on the chin, I take it on the chin, every time, every time, every time.
Yeah, there we go. Half Gringa in Studio 435 tonight. That was the song Marte, Izzy Olive, and Sam Cantor in studio. They're parts of the band, which will be at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee on Saturday night and at Shuba's on December 10th. That's next Sunday. That's what it is. They're in studio tonight, Half Gringa. Why don't we do this? We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll hear from the artists and hear some more music here in Studio 435 on the download. Stay with us. It's a download, 720 WGN, Studio 435 tonight, special Wednesday edition. Chicago's Half Gringa in studio. They just put out their debut LP, Grunonia. Grunonia. get that done.
You're so close.
I'm getting so close. I'm gonna, by the end of this segment, I'm going to get it. Half Gringa is Izzy Olive and Sam Cantor in studio tonight. There's other performers as well, but we're in the stripped-down version. It's the songwriting project for Izzy Olive, and she is in studio along with Sam. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
So I said at the beginning, this is kind of classified as rowdy rural rock music. Mm. What does that mean? I love that.
I guess it's just sort of, it was when I was writing the music for this LP, it was sort of a goal, but also something that had kind of just occurred in the natural formation of Half Gringa as a full band. Our sound became a lot more sort of like rough and tumble as I added more people into the project. Originally, I was just doing this as a solo project, and it was just me like recording with an acoustic guitar in my dorm room in college. and it went by the name Tin Silos, and then I started playing with a full band and then realized like the name didn't quite fit and that we were sort of developing this really specific sound, and I wanted something that felt more like an identity to me, that was sort of like a question, an open question about my own identity. So I changed the name, and just quickly we kind of found that sound.
Well, I mean, the evolution of the style of music that you're playing, because what mm-hmm. you're talking about, the earlier iteration stuff was a little bit more country music or alt country. I don't want to say country, sort of Nashville country, but like an alt country. Listening to Half Gringa, I mean, there's horns in the selections. There's just a much more mixture of music and instrumentation. Is that by design to evolve into something that's a little bit more complicated?
It is. Most of it has to do with just the people I added to the project. Like, I knew a really talented trumpet player named Ivan Paizo, and I had met him when we were at U of C together, and I just knew that I really wanted him. And I'd always kind of toyed with the idea of having something that wasn't a stringed instrument, as sort of a lead instrument. And I immediately thought of him and how good of a horn player he is. And so I asked him to start playing with us, and he did a really good job of arranging his own parts for the record. And so I think that just sort of that sound developed because, you know, I kind of just said, hey, do whatever you like.
I mean, that's something I have a lot of bands in, and we talk about and we get into the theory of music and everything. But when you can have a horn player that can arrange his own parts, I mean, there's a lot of different ways a horn can sound on any rock track.
Yeah.
For someone to come in with that skill, that's got to be helpful.
Ivan is incredibly talented. So, yeah. And it was a thing where I didn't want to mess too much with the things that he was already bringing me because they were so good. So I just sort of let him, you know, grow into that part and sort of figure out a way to fit them around the other things like my guitar tone and Sam's guitar tone and Andres's bass lines. And so, yeah, it really was my goal to sort of showcase everyone's talents on that record, and to sort of present a full band iteration of the work that we'd been doing for so long. So,
you know, I heard you mention the fact that you were singing songs in your dorm room at University of Chicago, and Ivan as well, talking about University of Chicago. Sam, I don't know your background, but I am interested in, I don't hear too much that comes out of that campus when it comes to music. And I don't mean it as a knock. I mean, there's great artistic, creative people that come out of Hyde Park and the University of Chicago. But you don't necessarily think of it as a breeding ground for Chicago musicians. Is there a lot going on there when it comes to musicians and artists and songwriters that are trying to make their name in Chicago?
You know, well, I can't speak for how the campus is now. It's been a couple years since I graduated, but when I was there, I mean, there were just like a lot of artists that I think the school is very self-selective. And I think that that is great in terms of coming in as an artist and just sort of like wanting to dabble in a bunch of different things. So like I majored in theater and English, which have, you know, nothing to do with music, the music department generally. And so, but I did music as sort of a side project. I was in a band with the bassist in our current band at that time. And that's sort of how I met Ivan. And Ivan started his own brass band while we were on campus called Dirt Red Brass Band.
Now that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I think of horns and jazz. And
yeah.
There's like a lot of connections to the University of Chicago.
And, yeah. And honestly, like, I think it was just a place where like the university really wanted us to like have free reign to kind of just like make our own name for ourselves and do whatever we wanted. And I think, you know, in lieu of maybe having the best program or the strongest music program, we did have the most freedom to kind of like do whatever we wanted and like start our own RSO that was, you know, like a weird band and opened for the off campus, like the comedy club.
Right.
And yeah, so I think, yeah, just having that freedom is,
you know,
really good.
I bring it up because Chicago is an extreme college town.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many great universities and colleges in Chicago, but it doesn't necessarily have the reputation for that. And I think about, at least in the ether, the concept that you could be on a college campus anywhere and you know, being a musician, trying to get the word out, getting people to come to your show, that kind of thing. But doing it in the backdrop of the city of Chicago, where there are so many bands, professional musicians, other people performing, is it helpful or is it a challenge to be a young musician trying to make your way in a big city like Chicago?
No, it's super helpful. I mean, I feel like the Chicago music community has just been so great and not as like, you know, sort of gatekeepery as I feel like other cities can be. And maybe part of it's just like we're Midwesterners and we're really friendly and we're all about community. But it was, yeah, it was just a thing that if you like find your weird niche of stuff that you really like and you just kind of like follow it, people will welcome you with open arms. And that's sort of how I got into that community. I will say that like being in Hyde Park itself was a little bit isolating, but like once I left, once I like graduated, I was a little bit worried like, oh, how am I going to like figure out how to do music in the city? And like it wasn't. Yeah, it just like wasn't that difficult. I just found people and keep finding people, and it's great.
Let's bring Sam in. Sam Cantor as well, play guitar in the Half Gringa, who's just in the track Marte we just heard. You know, for you, being a part, because I said at the beginning and I said it again, this is a songwriting project, not necessarily classified as a band. You know, being a part of a songwriting project that is somebody else's, mm-hmm. How do you see yourself fitting in? I mean, is it different collaboration than what we traditionally know as a band? Is it more open creatively? Explain the idea of being part of somebody else's songwriting project.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what we know of as a band, that's like a really diverse term. So like some bands write collaboratively and everyone writes their own parts and someone's in charge of lyrics or whatever, or you have multiple songwriters in a band, like the Beatles is a famous example. Other bands are like fronted by somebody, one woman or man or person, and that everyone else just kind of answers to them. And then there are projects. People tend to like, and I think that's something that has come up. I'm sure it has existed for a long time, but I think a lot of the artists that I have admired have sort of developed projects around their own songwriting. And so they bring in different collaborators rather than bandmates. And they get to shape, whoever's sort of in charge of the project gets to shape whose voice is added. But then it becomes a collaborative effort inevitably.
The art is the collaboration as opposed to the venture that is the band.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's so much that goes into past the art and the creativity of the band that was in here last, Studio 435, talking about touring around the country, and they all have to take off work and come together as a family. But it's different when you're talking about a collaboration of artists that know that they're there for that purpose.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think, and that's why it's kind of great, because I feel like the possibilities are endless in that way. Like, you know, I keep meeting so many musicians that I love in the city that I'm like, I'd love to collaborate with you. I'd love to like bring you in for like some sort of half gringa iteration. Cause yeah, we have the full band that we do. And then sometimes I just play solo, and then sometimes, and then now we're doing this duo thing. And then a couple of times we've done a trio with me, Sam, and Ivan. And yeah, I just feel like it's great to explore. It really kind of gets you closer to your own work, in a way, and makes you look at it in different, at different angles. It's just really helpful for the process.
Are there challenges in the way that you may collaborate with musicians who don't take ownership of it, who may say, oh, you know what, you should find a different guitar player tonight, I got other things to do?
Totally depends. I mean, it is very hard to coordinate
between a bunch
of different people. But I think, you know, generally, I think people are really willing. Like, if people like your work and are really into what you do, you know, they know that you can sort of take the lead on something and it'll be really great. And also personally, like, I love being part of projects where I'm not the one in charge. It's a nice change of pace. And just like, I'm sort of following this other person's like vision or dream. So I think, I think that that's something that musicians in Chicago are really about and open to.
Yeah. And I would just add to that, that I'm relatively new to the Chicago scene and moved here less than 2 years ago. And, you get what you put into the scene, you know, and this is one of the first projects that I got involved with since moving here, besides the things that I had myself. And you get so much out of, that's how you meet people, that's how you feel like a part of this city being vibrant. Like, you can hear about Chicago being a vibrant music city, but like, what does that mean until you're actually creating things with the people? And yeah, I just think being a part of Half Gringa has been a great gateway to...
Yeah, it's about relationships, yeah.
Yeah.
Sam Cantor and Izzy Olive in studio, part of the project, Izzy's project, Half Gringa. They're going to be at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee on Saturday night. They're going to be at Shuba's on December 10th in Lakeview. But they're here tonight, Studio 435. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. More live music. Half Gringa, stay with us. All right. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Special Studio 435 on a Wednesday instead of a Monday. Our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in our Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. Tonight, Chicago's Half Gringa. Izzy Olive and Sam Cantor are in studio tonight. They're half of Half Gringa. Almost half. Close to trying to go there. They're going to be at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee on Saturday night. Shuba's on December 10th. Grunonia. It's Nononia, right?
Onia.
Grunonia. Got it.
Almost. Yeah.
So close. Is the name of the LP, and they are ready to perform their next song. This is called Peach Season. Take it away, guys.
They come stipple-sized sheaves of life I leaf through on the train. I still suck on sweet and bland. I close my chest with two hands, pressed up awake for miles of cumbersome humidity. Summer gets away from me, thank God. I remember my mom and what she said. Thoughts thread, I've long lain in this bed. I've seen most things. I need a peach branch green for peace. Wicked raw pasture reach. Every word that bloomed in my mouth mixed so I can't figure out what hurts where. I need air. Pushed myself and fell to not get free. Pour the life out of me. Can you see it? Long and lean. I go reflecting hard, monument to my incompetence in this car. Every time I get the chance to talk through our whole circumstance, succumb to brackish dread and sweet insensitivity. Midwest winter brings out tooth and claw. In December I thawed too soon for you. Put the truth on ice and torch the proof. I've said most things. I need a peach branch green for peace. Wick and raw past your reach. Every word that bloomed in my mouth mixed so I can't figure out what hurts where. I need air. Pushed myself and fell to knock it free. Pour the life out of me. Can you see it? Long and lean. Sick inside, it ebbs and flows like low tide. And I know what you are up against. Future, past, and present tense. But all the truth is maimed by me. The plainness of my empathy. Must be nice to just be living. Honey, I'm a talker and a wanter and a winner. I'm destroyed. Ooh, your eyes, doe wide in deep dreams I hide. Concrete clots my chest and yet you scoop me up. I need a peach branch green for peace. Wick and raw past your reach. Every word that bloomed in my mouth mixed so I can't figure out what hurts where. I need air. Pushed myself and fell to knock it free. Pour the life out of me. Can you see it? Long and lean.
Yeah. There you go. Half Gringa in studio tonight. Studio 435, that was Izzy Olive and Sam Cantor in studio. They are that's the project Half Gringa, which is Izzy's songwriting project. Two of the members, Izzy and Sam, in studio. They're going to be at Cactus Club in Milwaukee on Saturday night. They're going to be at Shuba's on December 10th, but they're here in Studio 435 tonight. That was the song Peach Season. Wonderful. You guys, thanks so much. It's so great.
Thank you.
You know, continuing the conversation we had just about, you know, trying to find the right musicians to collaborate with and to be able to find a way to get your artistic vision through by working in projects as opposed to bands. How do you find the musicians that you collaborate with? How in a big city like Chicago do you find the right Sam and other players who can execute the vision that you set forth?
Well, I cheated a little bit because I went to school here and I happened to go to school with a bunch of really talented people. So two of the members of my band I went to school with. I think that the first way, like the first rule of like collaborating and like getting people to collaborate is to just go to shows, like go to a ton of shows. And that was one thing that one of my mentors told me is like, if you want to play music in Chicago, you just need to like go out and see some stuff, talk to some people. Like that's going to be the way to do it. So I think that that's been for me the most helpful thing. I met Sam because we had a mutual friend in New York who I'd played with before. Okay. And he and I played our band separately, played a show together, and then he was like, I would like to play with you sometime maybe. And I was like, okay, you can just be in my band if you want to. So that's another way, like once you've started playing shows, that's kind of how I've found more collaborators, is just by playing with more bands.
Is it easy to to find connections with artists when, by going to shows? I mean, is Chicago open like that, where musicians are looking to collaborate, or is it really at a certain point where they feel like they have their artistic thought down and now it's just about getting people butts in seats?
I would say in my experience, it's very open to collaboration. There have been a couple of times where, and I think, you know, it also depends on your level of like putting yourself out there. Like, I have seen so many great shows where afterwards I'll go up to the musicians and be like, hey, that was really great. I would love to like maybe play with you sometime, or like, can I, you know, like sit and talk to you for 5 seconds or whatever, you know, just chatting people up and sort of telling them what you're interested in and what kind of stuff you've been working on. And I think the idea of like a project is really, yeah, again, just really appealing to people, because then I think it's a little bit less like cemented in stone than saying like, will you be in my band?
Right,
it's like,
right.
Will you like
it's
maybe play
issue.
A couple
right.
shows with me? Well, and because like people like to, you know, sort of trade around and play.
Well,
in other
I think about
and...
other creative pursuits.
Mm-hmm.
Acting comes
mm-hmm.
to mind, where you're in a play for a couple months and
yeah.
then you're done with it. I mean, it does seem, you may be right, like approaching someone saying you want to be in my band.
Yeah.
Like forever?
Like, ooh, man.
That's
yeah.
a
it's
long
like you're asking
time.
Someone to get like a matching tattoo with you and it's not quite there yet.
Sam, does all of this seem, is it similar in your as someone who came here from Chicago, didn't go to school here, came from Connecticut? Has it been an easy transition for you to find creative people to perform with?
Yeah, well, it has been. I was living in the Boston area for a number of years before. I grew up in Connecticut, but I was living in the Boston area just before moving to Chicago. And there's a couple things about the scene here that were just so positive in terms of like landing. And number one, people really are more open here than they are on the East Coast in general, I felt. I think that's a function of like an attitude, maybe a regional attitude, but also just the fact that there's so much going on here, and there's not as much of a need to like compete with people. And I really think the overall attitude here is everyone's trying to lift everybody else up. And I don't know I mean, I haven't lived in so many places and I haven't pursued music as actively anywhere else as I have here, but I know that it's a really special vibe here in terms like my experience with meeting really talented musicians has just been only positive, and that's really special.
You know, in the music world, and I think about what you said because I hear that a lot from artists that come through the show and any discipline. And I think about theater artists because they'll talk about a lot, just like we just talked about with the play, but they'll talk about how it is a giving community where there's a lot of communication and collaboration between the artists and people are open. But there's also the point where they say this is a great place to learn and take risks and try new things because you're here to perfect your craft so you can go to be on Broadway or go be on television or whatever it might be in places that are much more about commerce than they are mm-hmm. about community. Is that similar for the music industry? Does Chicago serve as a place for you to be insanely creative and collaborative, but almost a stepping stone kind of thing? So if you really want to get serious about it, you need to be in a different town?
I mean, I don't think that the latter part of that is true. Like, I think that Chicago has certainly made its own name for itself in several different genres in regards to music. But I do think that it is a great place because of its, like, affordability, because the community is so open and so vast that and because of the, like, kind of diversity of venues, like in the DIY community, like house shows, and then also with like smaller places, like the Hungry Brain is one of my favorite mm-hmm. places in town to play. And yeah, just like smaller rooms. It's just way easier to kind of get started and book your shows if you really want to, you know? I think it's a great place to just get your career started, but also like keep it going. You know, like I don't think that my goal isn't to move to New York. Or Los Angeles or anything like that. Like I pretty much think I'm a Midwesterner for life for sure. And I love Chicago and I don't see myself leaving this community anytime soon. I think maybe there are some artists that kind of view it that way and that's fine. Mm. But yeah, I don't want for anything.
It's obviously changing with some of the more popular music that's coming out of Chicago and calls Chicago home.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. And you said my favorite phrase that I hear from so many different musicians was house shows.
Yeah.
I'm so into it. Like, I'm just so into it from the musicians that come in and they just nonchalantly throw that out. I'm like, house show? Well, tell me more. I have gotten so deep with bands and artists about where the house shows are and how the house shows play and all this kind of thing. It's like, my curiosity for this.
Interesting.
I love it. Yeah. I think it's cool. I think it's great that there's like a whole underground and a movement of house shows for musicians to be able to play. I think it's awesome.
I mean, it's great, and it's also super necessary, you know, especially for people in marginalized groups whose work isn't necessarily being actively picked up by buyers in town. Like, that's a great resource for them. And it's also a place where people can create their own space where they feel safe, you know, like people of different gender identities as well. It's just like, you know, there are some times when I've been to shows in bars and it's like, you kind of get this vibe that you're not necessarily welcome there.
Or you're not the target audience.
And it's nice to be able to build your own target audience.
Yeah. Izzy Olive, Sam Cantor, part of the project Half Gringa, which is in Studio 435 tonight. They're going to be at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee on Saturday and at Shuba's on December 10th coming up here. All right, we'll take our last break. We'll come back and we'll get one last live track from Half Gringa in Studio 435. Stay with us. All right, so download 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman here, Studio 435. In it, Chicago's Half Gringa, the songwriting project of Izzy Olive, who's in studio with Sam Cantor, two of the members of Half Gringa. There's others as well. They are playing at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee on Saturday night. Shuba's on December 10th. Their debut album, Grunyona. Close enough? Like, you saw the evolution of me mispronouncing that that where I got it? All right, good. Izzy Olive, Sam Cantor in studio. Here is the last track in Studio 435. It's called The Architect. Take it away, guys.
I was there looking up the mountainside. I was there when you said it was alive. It's not God burning through the anthracite. I'm over night. I'm over night. We drove by a truck of bones in plain daylight. Just a pile uncontained, I went wide. The takeoff made me cry, but I took it, tell me why. I didn't come here just to lie. I didn't come here not to try. My fear hooked my arm, stole me from where I come, left me for dead. Oh, please, I just get up and leave. More champagne, no complaints, knees on tile, my suitcase dragging me through the streets, dragging me through the streets. More champagne, no complaints, knees on tile, my suitcase dragging me through the streets, dragging me through the streets. My fear hooked my arm, stole me from where I come, left me for dead. Oh, please, I just get up and leave. We wait in line some more. You are the quiet one now. You are an architect, once I can tell. sleepless, I'm unseen, I don't make mistakes. 25, no kind advice that I won't take. We made all the same signs, two sets at the same time. I mistook my loneliness for bravery. 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 Took my loneliness for bravery.
Yeah, there we go. Af Gringa, the songwriting project of Izzy Olive. And Sam Canter in studio tonight. They're going to be at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee on Saturday night. They're going to be at Shuba's on December 10th. They're here tonight, Studio 435. Half Gringa, a pleasure. The music's tremendous, you guys. I can't thank you enough for coming in and being our guest tonight, Studio 435. I appreciate it.